If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
This is James Gilmore, co-author of The Experience Economy, competing for customer time, attention, and money. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome James Gilmore to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the book he's co-authored with Joseph Pine, The Experience Economy, Competing for Customer Time, Attention, and Money, published by Harvard Business Review Press. James Gilmore is an author, speaker, and management advisor to organizations throughout the world, helping them go deep on innovative ways to create customer value and new revenue. Jim is an assistant professor in the Innovation and Design Department in the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. He's also a Batten Fellow and adjunct lecturer at the Darden Graduate School of Business at the University of Virginia, where he teaches a course on the experience economy. And he is also a visiting lecturer in apologetics at Westminster Seminary, California. In addition to the experience economy, Jim co-authored Authenticity, What Customers Really Want, which was released by Harvard Business Review Publishing. And his latest book is Look, A Practical Guide for Improving Your Observational Skills. Jim is a graduate of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and an alumnus of Procter & Gamble. And, interesting fact, he is the former governor of Virginia. Governor, congratulations on the experience economy and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, you're going to do that to me, are you?
You're not the former governor of Virginia, Jim Gilmore?
No, although I think I did as well in the polls the last time he ran for president, which was zero.
Right. Well done. Oh, no, I thought you were the former governor, and I was going to, as a resident of Virginia, I was going to thank you for reducing the car tax. And
yes, you're one term you have in Virginia, if I understand it, for your governors.
That's correct. So, all right. So you're not that Jim Gilmore. So all the people, and it's interesting that you also teach at the University of Virginia. So I should mention that this book was highly recommended by our recent guest on the Marketing Book Podcast, Daryl Amey, author of The Revenue Growth Engine. And then I was able to reach out to the nice folks at Harvard Business Review Press, and here we are. So I should mention that also that this book really helped to rewire my marketing brain. And some people will think I don't have a brain, but I've had a number of books on the show about customer experience, and I've learned a lot, and maybe I'm a slow learner. But the context in which you all wrote this book had a really significant impact on better understanding the importance of experiences, and we're going to talk about that. But this book was actually written a while back, and you all have updated it a couple of times. Is that right?
Yes. First, we had a re-released in paperback with a complete revised edition. And it actually was a student at Darden at the University of Virginia who came up to me after a week-long January term course and said, Mr. Gilmore, they don't say professor at UVA, like Mr. Jefferson's University.
Oh, of course.
Mr. Gilmore really enjoyed the course and really enjoyed the book, but man, the examples are really old. And it like stated the obvious and, you know, just contacted Harvard. And it started off with just, let's swap out the examples, like less American Online and more, you know, Facebook and Google mm-hmm. kind of, because it was written in 1999 originally, actually at the height of the dot-com boom. We did not get sucked into that. So, and we also wrote a new preface mm-hmm. to the book at that time. And then Harvard, was December of 2019, re-released the book in hardcover, which I don't think is a very common thing. But you know, the book just continues to sell briskly and find new readers. So we wrote yet another, new preface, sort of talking about what we had, seen happen over the course of 20 years and also sort of framing where we thought we ought to go forward. Of course, released in December of 2019, the timing of that was
just in time for the pandemic.
Exactly. Perfect. You know, so we had to rethink a little bit yet again, on the state of the experience economy since then. But yeah, the book, you know, it just, I'm so blessed. Joe and I are so blessed. It just, I think we just, I often say we identified a long-term structural change in the very fabric of advanced economies, and therefore it's enduring. It's not a flavor of the month. It's not have a relevancy for a year and then on to the next idea. It's something really to wrestle with in corporations, big or small.
If I had a little more time, I would probably go back and read the 1999 version just to see.
Well, the 99. Oh yeah. Well, actually,
because it didn't seem dated at all. It was seemed quite contemporary.
Well, part of it is you're reading the updated. But one of the things I loved about the original version is we had call-outs. And if you can get a copy of it, let's say a used copy on your favorite online bookseller, who would that be? just to read the call-outs. I tell people often, if you've not experienced it, get that copy and you know the enlarged fonts. It's sort of the thread. The spine of the book that Harvard did a magnificent job. And that style, I think, has fallen out of favor in terms of book format. So, you know, it looks rather, you know, no longer has that form.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, let me read an excerpt from the beginning. And there's so much we could talk about, but I'm going to zero in on a few things that I think would really be helpful for the listeners and which really helped me tremendously. You write, most companies try to demand attention from current and prospective customers by targeting them with standard marketing methods such as TV advertising, billboards, and search queries. But in today's experience economy, it's crucial to captivate customers by going beyond these means, by supplying them with experiences that create willing buyers. To capture customers' attention, you must stage experiences worthy of attention. This book provides a plethora of foundational principles, design frameworks, and operating guidelines that will help you create memorable experiences that do truly engage, in particular, experiences that are robust, cohesive, personal, dramatic, and even transformative. Jim, can you go back in time a bit and set the stage for where we are in the experience economy? And I'm talking about, take listeners back to, you know, commodities, goods, services, and now the experiences. And you even talk about the progression of economic value. That was very, very helpful for me to see how the experience economy fits in. And then we can also talk about how it's actually more profitable.
Sure. Well, you're speaking to the foundational model of our work, which we call the progression of economic value, which is a way of looking, you know, it's a business book, but it really has an economic premise that underlies it. And the foundation, the progression of economic value really is a way of looking at the last 200 plus years of economic history. If you go back 200 or so years, nearly everybody lived or worked on the farm extracting commodities, and the extraction of animal, vegetable, mineral was the basis of that agrarian economy, predominantly agriculture, thus the agrarian economy. But then we automated those jobs and people shifted to the factory with the emergence of the industrial economy. And in turn, those jobs were automated with the forces of productivity and automation. And we shifted to a service economy. In the United States, it was actually in the 1950s when for the first time a majority of people worked in services. And we cite in the book a United Nations study from probably 10 years ago now or more, that for the first time in world history, more people on the planet are employed in services than in agriculture. Manufacturing is still number one worldwide, but only because of craft production in less developed countries like basket weaving in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. In the United States, and indeed, which is representative of other advanced countries, United States, you have less than 10% of the population, the working population working in manufacturing, and less than 3% in agriculture. So we've shifted to services. And what we wrote in the book is that services like commodities and goods before were being automated with the same forces of productivity, and that in order to remain prosperous, we have to shift to experiences as a distinct economic offering. The economic contention is that experiences are as distinct from services as services are from goods. And while there are many applications of experiences, we ought to perhaps talk about that, particularly as we look back on how the book has had an impact. The fundamental issue is that we need to start charging for the time that people spend in places and events, that the commodities, goods, and services are increasingly commoditized, increasingly difficult to extract, make, or deliver profitably, and what consumers most value is the experience they derive from commodities, goods, and services. So rather than charging for the means, you buy a bicycle, you ride it, you get a bicycle riding experience, mm-hmm. but to increasingly think about the bicycle riding itself as something that can be charged for, and then the good just merely becomes a prop for that experience. And
right.
A quick example that illustrates this for many folks, particularly in North America, let's start there, is, birthday parties. You go from mm-hmm. parents buying flour, sugar, cake, cocoa, and making a cake from scratch, buying commodities, 10 or 20 cents worth, then, shifting in the 80s to buy a cake mix made at a factory, goods, then calling the bakery, have a cake made for them, cake making service. And then the 90s, in the US at least, parents, bought the birthday party, Chuck E. Cheese's, et cetera, something that was once free. Mm-hmm. I had birthday parties growing up, but they were at home. They were self-staged, if you will. And more globally, we often talk about coffee, commodity coffee trades in the market for 5 or 10 cents, depending on whether it's Arabica bean or not, or the Robusta bean. And then you can buy packaged coffee, costs you about 10, 15 cents a cup. You can buy coffee at a McDonald's around the world for the equivalent of 99 cents. And then, of course, if you spend time in a place like Starbucks that can charge you, or other cafes, can charge you $3, $4, or $5 for essentially providing a place to spend time drinking that coffee.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how customers are less willing to spend time, attention, and money on just goods and services now because they want to spend more money on the experiences. And there's a few parts here at the beginning just to get the CFO's attention. It's the experiences are more profitable. Is that right?
Well, they can be. Like anything else in business, they have to be executed well. I mean, you can even have wonderful experiences that people value, but not manage your costs. Nothing about the other disciplines of business go away.
Right.
It's just it now becomes more difficult because this is layered on top. And even if you're in an industry or a business that hasn't shifted aggressively to experiences yet, once somebody else does, it has the effect of commoditizing what you offer. And indeed, in industry after industry, we see this shift, even in ways that people don't normally even recognize. I mean, any subscription, right? Even any shared economy offering is shifting towards paying for time. And even things like whenever you pay a flat fee at a restaurant, as opposed to charging per entree, that's a subtle but significant pricing mechanism change between a dining experience and a food service. And you always get a dining experience, right? But when you charge a flat fee, regardless of what entree you order, you just pay the same fee. That acts like an admission fee in its functionality. So, again, there's other applications besides charging explicitly for an experience offering. You've mentioned marketing, for example, but that's still the ultimate thing that Joe and I are really proselytizers about.
Yes, and the first line of the book is Call me Ishmael. No, not really. That's not the first.
One should always aspire for that kind of impact.
Yes. But I thought of that because the first line of the book is, time is the currency of experiences. And you go on to outline three questions that loom large in today's experience economy. And I'm going to go through these quickly. One is, are your customers increasing or decreasing the amount of time they spend with you? Number two is, do you have to exert ever more marketing and sales efforts to gain the attention of customers? Or do the experiences you offer create robust demand in and of themselves? And the third one is the money customers pay you derived entirely from the sale of commodities, goods, and services, or have you found ways to explicitly charge fees for various experiences? And you started to touch on this with the restaurant, but you, in the book, you all write that too many companies give away pretty much any experiences they add in order to better sell their goods and services. And this seems like a lot of companies do this. Why is that actually not a good idea?
Well, if you don't recognize experiences as a distinct offering, something that can command a fee, then you're likely to miss it. And it, just sheer inertia. This is even, you know, Christian Clayton, Clayton's work, you know, about the innovator's dilemma, that you tend to rely upon past practices. Mm-hmm. Take my old employer, Procter & Gamble, who, you know, purchased Gillette sometimes ago. They weren't the ones who started, you know, Dollar Shave Club, where you could pay, you know, $1, $3, or $6 a month subscription, right, for the year, you know, and just had the razors subsumed inside of that offering. So, you know, often it is innovators from the outside, as with anything. So you have to recognize experiences, and you have to take, you know, the logical starting point is to look at those goods and services that you make or deliver, and then ask, well, to look at the time people spend using those goods or interacting with those services, and look for opportunities to fashion that time as an economic offering. And again, there's, you could think of examples where people used to, well, let's even back up before experiences. You know, it used to be everybody owned a lawnmower. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Keeping up with the Joneses.
I still do.
Okay, well, good for your rarity, perhaps, in some communities. It used to be keeping up with the Joneses was, you know, the best and newest, you know, lawnmower. And, well, you know, increasingly people pay a landscaping service to do that. You know, mm-hmm. that used to be an activity of maybe a teenager in the neighborhood. A little bit of commerce going on, but not as an enterprise that's incorporated and hiring people, you know, and then if you extend that, you know, it's if you pay for time to be in some gardens or to take a landscaping class, for example, then you're starting to shift to charging for the time people spend in some activity. And there's many opportunities that businesses just don't see.
Yes.
They don't recognize that what people value is the time they spend with their goods and services. And I'll even give you more another example to get more to the heart of it in this technological time. I have a picture of all the computer peripherals I had in my own old home. You know, a printer and a fax machine. Remember those? You know, a desktop photocopier. And every single one of them I had replaced a multiplicity of times. The fax machine broke down. I used to smash them in the driveway afterwards in a fit of rage.
Oh, like the movie Office Space?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yes, yes. Yeah, maybe there was a subtle influence there. My kids would always be amused. Then I'd go buy a new fax machine with no confidence that paying more money would mean an increased quality. So I'd buy an ever cheaper fax machine, and down the spiral goes. And again, same with the printers and so forth. And think about the economic waste, all those resources used. By the way, because quality is not the same as durability, right? Mm-hmm. The zero defects doesn't necessarily mean how long is it going to last. My dad bought quality things growing up that, you know, maybe there were defects in them, but they lasted a long, long time. But imagine, you know, a printer company, or even quite frankly, laptop, or, you know, my goodness, a smartphone, where you paid an annual fee and the goods was subsumed. And it will behoove the manufacturer then to actually use less of the Earth's resources, sell less physical goods, right, for all the computing time. If you just charge for the time, then you would actually make a more durable offering, or you'd only change out the components of the computer, the printer, or the smartphone as you actually need them. We probably have more former smartphones and mobile phones in landfills than are in actual use today.
Yes.
And we see this with automobiles. What I almost had in early speaking engagements after the book was published, I remember being with Ford Motor Companies and just advocating. This was after they had purchased Aston Martin and Volvita, Volvo, you know, bought all these brands, and said, why don't you offer a membership where you can have access to a portfolio of vehicles, right, at your access. It's like you might purchase the car, but increasingly people move to a full service lease and pay a premium. They might pay a premium to have a Ford F-150 for the weekend and then switch to a minivan and then a Mustang convertible and so forth. But I had assumed individual ownership. And what you have with ride sharing with Uber and Lyft is exactly that model. And increasingly, you will have people who will not buy a car, not lease a car, but rely solely upon buying for the time they're being transported. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking taxi cabs without this, as we say in the book, without the sacrifice of having to hail a cab, your walk 5 blocks hotel where you know there's taxis. But you know, it's mass customized, which we have 3 chapters in the book about. It's mass customized transportation service. Here I am. Where's the nearest driver? Pair them. Go. You know, just like making Dell computers, or at least how they used to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, I should add that there's a little bit of overlap with the whole idea of the subscription economy or the membership economy going on out there. So it's really very, very interesting.
We quote Joel Stein from Time Magazine, who did an article on the shared economy, where he basically said the shared economy, which is subscription, the shared economy is the experience economy. It's just a subset. Right. It's just a pricing mechanism. The highest order, the umbrella concept is how you think about the customer's time, not your good, not your service activities. It's their time reliant upon your goods and services. No doubt about that. They have to be quality. They have to be reasonable costs and so forth, but they are the enablers of everybody's time. And by the way, not just consumer, but also in business to business context as well.
Yeah. So I want to read this one part that I think is going to be very either frightening or enlightening for the listeners. It certainly was for me. And part of this I want to carve in stone. It's where you talk about the advertising to experience ratio. And you're right, companies should therefore look intensely at where they spend their demand generation money and seek to shift the ratio of advertising to experiences. Doing so effectively turns marketing into a profit center as it makes money in and of itself, precisely because the activity provides time well spent. And this is the part that needs to be carved in stone. Advertising just doesn't work the way it used to. It's increasingly difficult to capture customers' attention with traditional advertising or other marketing campaigns. And then you go on to write, experience staging easily resolves this problem. For while advertising interrupts what people want to do, experiences can actually offer them something they want to do. And then you, right after that, you write, advertising has largely become a phoniness generating machine. So lots of things there to talk about.
Well, that last thing draws from our authenticity book. But yes, if you recognize that marketers and marketing departments and marketing agencies have recognized that the experiential value, but they've applied that to demand creation. You know, market—that's really the discipline. I like to call it demand creation without any qualms that's what it is, and that marketing's have been the custodian of that for decades, and they've recognized that people want experiences, and so less flat media, less advertising, and more 360 marketing or event-based marketing. And if those companies make all that investment in staging those experiences, one of the benefits of charging a fee for those experiences is not only will it force you to create a better experience in that it's worthy of that fee, right? But also if you can command a fee that actually generates a profit, we think there's infinite return on investment. Because normal investments in marketing, you hope to get a return based on more sales of your traditional goods and services. But if the event itself can generate a profit, then you may not only have the benefit of increased sales of your traditional goods and services, but you've done so while simultaneously making money. Yeah. So that's one way in for this is to take some of the events that you have that you might be doing solely for demand creation and maybe not charging for them. Mm-hmm. Or if you're entertaining launching some new event, to ask yourself, what would we do differently if we charged an admission? You may not have to. You'll at least come up with ideas you would not come up with if you had not asked yourself that question. And if you answer that question rigorously and thoroughly enough, you may at the end of the day go like, we could charge admission for that. And in fact, the admission fee might be a signal to people to want it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. What? Yeah. What you pay for, kind of thing. And you know, even marketing before our book was written, even Schmidt at NYU, his book, he had been applying this thinking to marketing as a marketing professor. I greatly admire his work, but he was calling this marketing aesthetics. It's only after his work that he and others started talking about marketing experiences, and we're like, that's great. We like calling him. They call it experiential marketing. We like to call them marketing experiences. Just flip that a little bit as a mental model. That no, these things should be worthy of a fee, and you know, less and less the advertisements are intrusions, right? And you know, that's inherently negative. Now, yes, you have the Super Bowl events where people might look forward, but look how even fragile that is. If you have a Super Bowl like we had in 2021, that's as awful as that game was. Yeah, you know, maybe it increases looking forward to the commercial, but maybe it's also people just checking out and like not even noticing. And
I heard today that the ratings for the 2021 Super Bowl were the lowest since 1969.
Yeah, right. And think about the $5 million they paid Bruce Springsteen, Jeep. And I drive a Jeep Wrangler. Think what kind of prototype experience. Now, granted, they already have a Jeep driving. They have Camp Jeep. They already understand this. But that's a marketing thing, and if you own a Jeep, you can go, and maybe they charge a fee. I've never gone myself, but think about what that money could have done in terms of actually creating an event or portfolio events that would be profitable in and of themselves. Especially, I mean, even with what's happened in the Corona crisis, the I know of companies who have taken old Streamline trailers and put them around as places. Or put it this way, has Jeep heard about Airbnb? You know, maybe they create some place where they partner with places and you have access to a Jeep while you're there.
Right.
And unavailable, maybe certain souped-up Jeeps no one could ever really afford to make that aftermarket investment. And again, if they're profitable enterprises, they can both stimulate demand to actually own a Jeep when you get back home, but also make money in and of themselves. I used to use as a provocation, and then it became like a serious matter, that every brand should think about opening up a hotel. I mean, what better way to immerse somebody in your brand than to actually be in it? Like Walt Disney talked about placing his customers in the cartoon, and thus thus Disneyland, and then Walt Disney World. If you're a smaller company, open up a B&B. Why having clients come to town, or open up an Airbnb? Just get a smaller dwelling and make it totally reflect your brand, and actually use the goods while you're staying in your hotel room. You've got captive time there, and you're letting them be in the Sheraton watching ESPN. You know? Right. And it's already an economic offering platform that exists. And maybe Marriott and Hilton wouldn't have talked to you about theming a suite to be a company suite, but Airbnb provides a VRBO. There's now platforms that you can access, not just for marketing purposes, but to actually have offerings that people will pay for, generate a profit, and simultaneously create demand. So we think chief marketing officers ought to be responsible for those experiences that do not command a fee. And the position of chief experience officer ought to be established for those experiences that command a fee. And hopefully over time, wean oneself off of the money devoted to non-revenue generating experiences to experiences that actually command a fee that people are willing to pay for.
Yes, having read the book, that seems like that's the direction it's going. You mentioned something just a moment ago that was one of those things in the book that hit me like a ton of bricks. And you mentioned it a few times in the book, and you say, what would we do differently if we charged for admission?
Yep.
What would we do differently if we charged for admission? And then elsewhere in the book, you write that you are what you charge for.
Yep.
But I want to ask you about what I think may be a misconception that companies have. You write that shifting up the progression of economic value that we've talked about doesn't simply mean adding entertainment to existing offerings. Is that a mistake a lot of companies make, thinking, oh, we just need to be more entertaining?
Oh, one of two primary ones, certainly one that was made early on. You know, you're just talking about entertaining people. Well, chapter two of our book talks about four different experiential realms, four different types of experiential value that together contribute to engaging customers. Yes, experiences should be fun and enjoyable. They should be entertaining. But entertainment is really sort of passive absorption, you know, watching a TV screen, people watching, even bird watching, for that matter. But there's educational value, which is much more active. You don't learn until you actually do something. More immersive and more active. Mm-hmm. Not so much, it's still absorption. You're absorbing content. But a teacher can conjugate the verb, do the math problem on the blackboard or whiteboard, but it's not until the student does her or his work that the actual learning occurs. Right, that's why people talk about flipping the classroom. And when my kids got to an age where they started taking algebra, they come home and they ask for help. I go, I don't remember any of this. You know, what are you doing in class? Oh, the teacher's up on the board. I'm like, no, watch the video you're home and then do your homework when you're at school. You know, that's Khan Academy and all those.
Yeah.
You know, so there's educational value. Can people participate? Not a demo at a trade show. What do you want them to actually do? There's escapist value. Right, mm-hmm. Being transported from one sense of reality to another, which is tourism, which is virtual reality, which is escape rooms or esports. It's all escaping from your everyday reality to another. That's a form of value. And then aesthetic with an E is the value of just hanging out and being there. So it's not entertainment is part of the equation, right? But not the totality of the equation. So that is actually my favorite model in the entire book, is to ask those four questions. How can you make it more fun and enjoyable? What do you want customers to learn from participating? How can you create a sense of being transported from one sense of reality? Theming comes into play there. And then finally, how can you want customers just to hang out and be? So those are four, again, design prompts for envisioning better experiences.
Mm. Let's go back in history one more time. And I want you to explain the following. When you all write that the history of all economic progress consists of charging a fee for what was once free.
Yeah, I'll address that and also sort of harken back to your question about the charging, the admission fee aspect. Mm-hmm. In fact, let me start with that. The whole notion of charging for experience, when Joe actually first articulated this, because he wrote a book, Mass Customization, also by Harvard. And Joe was fond of saying, if you customize a good, you automatically turn that good into a service. And he was actually asked in an executive education session, well, you want us to customize our services too. If we customize a service, what do we automatically turn that into? To which he just responded viscerally in experience. I remember he called me that night and said, Jim, guess what I said today? All right. So customization is a path up. So once we had this articulate, and Joe, I think, was the first to say experience is a distinct economic offering. I'm like, wow. And I immediately had recalled, I think within my first year working for Procter & Gamble in the early 80s, I was visiting some college friend in Chicago and had heard that Nike Town had opened and right on Michigan Avenue. And I wanted to go see it. And when I got there, there was a rope line to get in. And I waited in line and went in. It was amazing. The early Nike Town was just a whole wall of every Sports Illustrated cover that had ever had a pair of Nikes on it, and just things that they've lost over time, frankly, because they don't charge admission. And I thought back on that and went, what if Nike would have charged to get into Nike Town?
Or part of Nike Town.
Or part of Nike Town, like American Girl Place. You can still go into American Place and shop for the goods, but they have a cafe and they've got a stage performance. They have a hair salon. Exactly right. So that was an early – and then, of course, we thought of Disney and charging admissions to theme parks, and that, okay, there are some economic offerings today, like going to a movie, paying for a sporting event. But then we sort of expanded – and we were hard-pressed, quite frankly, then to say, well, where are places that are charging – admission. And now there's always new. I mean, just iconically, I first hear about escape rooms. That's interesting. Thousands upon thousands around the world operating, well, till COVID. And then like rage rooms, pay to go smash things up. Salt rooms, you pay to be in Himalayan salt. I took my wife on a date to a salt room. It's like I paid $60 per person for like essentially a massage room with like no masseuse. The margins on this are fantastic. So again, if you're a hair salon, you think about those kinds, with the mindfulness movement, here's an interesting anecdote you might enjoy in this whole issue of charging a fee for what was once free. An anecdote that I think is insightful. I remember years ago, I read a front page article in the Wall Street Journal about how Barnes & Noble had decrease in quarterly sales, and they attributed it to the decline in coloring book sales. That made the front page of the Wall Street Journal, because it was that coloring book craze, right? Where you buy, and my wife and daughter were into it. So I went to my wife and said, Beth, when's the last time you bought some coloring books? She goes, it's been months and months and months, because I got so many, I'll never be able to complete them all. Okay, right? She has enough goods to last a lifetime. You know, maybe she'll get some. Well, what if, you know, Barnes & Noble would open up a coloring book room? You know, whiteboard walls, projector that puts the images up on the wall. You go, you know, mother, daughter activity. It's mindfulness. You play some calm music in there. Pay for time doing the color ring.
Uh-huh.
You know, they might have been able to sustain revenue around adult coloring books, which is what they were, versus sort of becoming a fad. They might have been able to sustain that. Or maybe even if it is a fad and runs its course, maybe you extend that, but then you look for the next thing that happens. Say, okay, now what do we change that room to? Which is very Vegas-like, right? Constantly refreshing the portfolio of experiences based on the evolving tastes of consumers. And in a place, you could do that. You can change a place and what occurs in that place a lot easier than changing the configurations of the components of some good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talk in the book about how there are so many theme restaurants that they burst onto the scene, they do well, and then they go out of business because refresh.
But the best ones are not called theme. If you do theming well, like there's great misconceptions of theming, and we're apologists for theming. If you do theming well, nobody calls you a theme restaurant. I could take you to Little Italy in Cleveland, where I live, to Mia Bella's or Etna, my two new favorites. They're Italian restaurants. Well, by the way, real Italian restaurants are in Italy. Right. But we feel quite comfortable calling them an Italian restaurant because, you know, the cuisine they serve, the decor and so forth. If you do it well, it's just that faceted version of theme restaurants.
Right.
You know, the Planet Hollywood. By the way, even Planet Hollywood, which has maybe one still open in Forum Shops in Vegas, if they had charged the admission fee, think about this. They picked a theme going to the movies that had a mechanism where people were used to paying an entry fee to buy a ticket to the movies. They could have, instead of charging $15 for the burger to try to recover the cost of all that investment in the environment, what if they would use the admission fee to subsidize the price of the burgers and fries? And be like, man, you know, because your sense of value is influenced by that price point. Like, this burger's not worth $15, right? And again, they could have themed not just the place. That's a huge mistake people make. They could have themed the time. They could have had Harrison Ford night. You know, mm-hmm. They could have had Forrest Gump Day. In fact, some of the investors in the enterprises were very actors in those movies. Again, here's another mistake. Besides thinking experiences are solely entertainment, many people make the mistake of thinking the environment is the experience. The environment is just the set.
Yes.
Right? It's the place in which people spend time. Commodities, goods, and services all exist outside of people. Right, whether they're tangible, you know, or intangible, but experiences happen inside of us. No two people can have the same experience. Period. Even if you and I go to the San Diego Zoo together or go to a baseball game together, same event, but our eyes wander to different places. Right, one person gets a foul ball at the game, and somebody else does not get the foul ball. Even in the, you know, nobody takes. If you just watch people at Walt Disney World, nobody takes the same path, even within a family. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's inherently personal. Which of course makes it more relevant to people's needs than something that's standardized for everyone, which is inherently what a good is.
Right, right. Well, so I guess back to the question of charging once free. I mean, it reminds me
of my
days on Madison Avenue many, many years ago. You know, the creative, the strategy, it was all free because we made money on media commissions.
Well, sure, exactly. That's, you know, commissions is a form that's always, you know, on the internet. Offerings are all, you know, real estate and so forth are challenging that.
Well, now we charge for those things because there's any media commissions.
Because you're forced to find. So if you come back like to my birthday parties, the birthday progression, for example, you know, it used to be, people, well, let's go back to this generically. In the agrarian economy, there were still goods, right? People, in fact, in the agrarian economy, people made their own shoes. They certainly made all their own meals. They built their own houses. In fact, they asked the neighbors to come over and help them. And then in exchange, we'll go help you when you build one. The principle mm-hmm. of pot latching, by the way. In the industrial economy, there are still services, but it was self-service. People changed their own oil. They mowed their own lawns, cut their own hair. I remember having a bowl on my head because my dad, you know, had shears and scissors. I like pleaded when I was a teenager, Dad, could I please go to a barber? That is, pay a fee to a barber for an activity we used to do ourselves. Right, that's the kind of, in the service economy. There's experiences, but they're all self-staged experiences. There were birthday parties, but they're all self-staged. Now you pay an enterprise to do this. So the history of all economic progress is to charge a fee for once free, or people did for themselves. There's a logical progression for any company to say, okay, what is that next echelon, that next level of value that can be created, focusing on the time people spend, not just the activities we perform, that is services, and not just the goods that we manufacture.
Yes. Well, let's go to another concept that I found very interesting and I think people would find helpful. And you write that if a company designs a worthwhile experience, customers will gladly pay the company to essentially sell to them. Explain what you mean there.
That's really a transition we make to talk about business-to-business enterprises, because we say, well, you know, so much of this is in the consumer marketplace, but what if you have a business-business relationship? Well, you have the long-established trade shows, like a dominant business-to-business experience where you pay a fee to attend an event to go see all the wares under one roof. But the notion is if you can stage an event, preferably one that people pay for, and that event creates demand, right? You're charging people to sell to them, if you will, right? Particularly if you ever want to change buyer behavior, right? They want to change their perception of requirements or what they'd like. We'll stage some event that demonstrates to them through their active participation about why some new criteria for purchase are necessary. They're probably not going to yell that at a sales presentation with PowerPoint. Caterpillar has a giant like sandbox in Wisconsin for basically in their sales process. Their prospective buyers can go and literally operate a bulldozer, cherry picker, so, you know, move mm-hmm. dirt around. And they had a notable increase in sales if they kept people to actually use the equipment versus being told about the equipment.
You think there's a connection there?
Exactly. Well, no. And then, by the way, interestingly, somebody saw that going on and said, ooh, why don't we just open that up for the consumer?
Yeah.
Right. So somebody opened it in Vegas. So I think it was called Big Dig. Now, interestingly, I think like Caterpillar, if they had daytime, they have B2B customers go there. And the nighttime, if they design it to be simultaneously available for consumers, that would actually subsidize the price of the operations for their primary market.
And buyers could bring their families.
Right. But if I can make a point about coronavirus on this, that I'm now, as people ask me, what's going on now with the experience economy? We did it for 20 years. Joe and I staged an event called Think About. And the only city we did twice was Las Vegas. And the second time we were there, very experiential event. And I borrow from it now for many of the different events I stage for clients, that we had one team that went out, and their whole job for like 6 hours was to go out and overlap daytime versus nighttime. They went out and interviewed taxi cab drivers and limo drivers. And one of the things they recognized that Las Vegas is actually two cities. There's the daytime Las Vegas, largely convention-based, and there's the nighttime Vegas. And taxi cab and limo drivers during the day, they'll never work in the night. They're like, there's no way I want that riffraff in my vehicle. Meanwhile, the nighttime driver's like, I'm not going to do daytime. They don't tip enough, right? And like they pile in five people to a vehicle. So it's really two cities. I thought, did it really take the corona crisis for hotels to recognize people don't just stay overnight, but they can stay over day? I've tracked at least six enterprises, and Hilton now has their own, where you can book a room just to go work in for a while. Because, again, escapist value, I want to get out of my house. Right. You know, I'll pay to be there for my work day.
Yeah.
And all you have to change is house cleaning operations, which they've had to do out of necessity now for health reasons and safety reasons. Mm-hmm. But that was – housekeeping was basically a mass production operation of going down the hall one room at a time, knock, knock, housekeeping, like an assembly line, versus, you know, putting motions – going into each room as they are vacated. And here's the tie back into what you charge for. There is, like the restaurant, there's a subtle but significant difference between charging a room rate and a day rate. A room rate, you're charging for the collection of services you perform, and by golly, you better be out by 11 o'clock because we have rooms to clean. Mm-hmm. If you charge a day rate, that is, you have a full 24 hours from any time you check in, which I first experienced at La Mertage in West Hollywood. I check in 8 o'clock at night. I'm like, man, I can stay during the day. Like, I'll book a later flight. The room is so awesome, right? That you have to, and their housekeeping, they put in heat and motion sensors to know whether you're in the room. So they know when to come knock on your door because they know you're not in there, and they don't even have to knock on the door. They still do, just for formality more than anything. But again, there's capacity to charge for more time. And here's an interesting thing with the corona crisis. That's very interesting that we wrote right before this happened in the new preface of the book. We made a distinction between time well saved and time well spent. And And service companies, people want to you want to spend less time with them. Like, let's do it quicker.
Right.
Then you'll simultaneously spend more time and money with experiences. Well, what the virus has done is caused many people to act differently. That saves them a lot of time. Right. You call from the grocery stores and swing by and pick it up. Likewise with meal. I was walking in my neighborhood not too long ago, and my neighbor is a dentist. He's actually an orthodontist. And I said, man, your business must really stink right now. He's like, oh, no. He says, all the fittings that were like mold-based, that I don't have to actually manipulate the metal braces, I'm doing all that online streaming. I mail them a kit. I counsel them and tell them what to do. And I'm thinking, think about the time. And he says, that's going gangbusters, and he doesn't think it's ever going to go back.
Yeah.
Think about no more 45-minute ride to the doctor, no waiting in the waiting room. I mean, first of all, waiting room, what a dumb idea that is. Like, you know, and help have people sit together that are sick and wait together. No drug. Then all that, but all that time being saved, when we come out of this, and any of those behaviors that are sustained, that actually frees up time to spend in new ways. I'm now doing the New York crossword puzzle every day that I never had time to do before. just from my drive time alone to class, which is, you know, an hour plus each day. There's my crossword puzzle time. Well, I sure wish I could go spend time on something besides my crossword puzzle. And once I'm able to get out of the house, I think I will.
Yeah. Well, now let's go back to something you mentioned that Joseph said to you years ago, and that was about customization. And I want you to expand on this, where you write that businesses that wish to forestall commoditization by entering the experience economy should first get their act together by customizing their goods and services.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, customization is a route to shift up the progression of economic value. Customize a good, automatically get a service. Customize a service, automatically get experience. Mm-hmm. Now, when Joe, his second Harvard Business Review article was called Making Mass Customization Work. And when that article appeared, like many of the more significant, in fact, I think you can measure which articles are more significant based on the nature and quality of the letters to the editor that come in afterwards. But Stan Davis, who coined the term mass customization in Future Perfect in 1987, he wrote a letter in response to that article, and he asked and answered this question. He said, what and where should you customize in an enterprise? Right, because you can't mass customization does not mean customizing everything for everyone. You'll go broke doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He wrote, this is brilliant business wisdom. He said you should customize as much as necessary and as little as possible. That is, identify those dimensions of your offerings that, if they were customized, would be of the greatest value. That is, you're providing them in one standard way, when in fact people vary greatly in how they want to experience that feature or benefit of the goods and services. But they settle for the one way. So I think it's the single most power, the most singular, powerful, and yet neglected concept in the entire experience economy. And that is the notion of customer sacrifice. Customer satisfaction, everybody recognizes, or I can't imagine any organization doesn't understand it, regardless of size or industry. But customer satisfaction is the gap between what people expect and what they perceive they get.
Mm-hmm.
That's even a J.D. Powers definition. It's the gap between what people expect, what they perceive they get. It's about meeting expectations. But our definition of customer sacrifice, layered on top of that, is the gap between what people settle for and what they want exactly. Right?
And you can beat them into, you talk about the airlines, like people are settling for not much.
Oh, well, in industry after industry, it's a new world of thinking. Like, wow, my customers they buy something. If it's not exactly what they want, there's dimensions it's close enough. This is, of all the mass produced goods and services, this is close enough. But if you can do it exactly, now, not for everything, but for those dimensions that if you were to customize it would be most valued, and again, also vary in how they, by the way, services are inherently customizable.
Yes.
Because they're intangible. In fact, the whole definition of poor service is you approach the front counter or the phone call, whatever it might be, and you have a unique set of needs, and they treat you like you're just another widget of a customer, the same standard way. And that creates sacrifice. So, you know, that's the reason to customize. There's not a reason to customize if people aren't settling for what they want exactly. And, you know, could cite many different anecdotes, but that it's. I wish that people would pick up on that concept more. It's like I even talk about sacrifice mapping. It's much better than journey mapping. You can just go throw that away. think about a map as like in geography. When you discover a new world, you map it, right? And by the way, you refine that map as you get greater and greater intelligence about what the actual world looks like. Where every customer that any business has, there's a world of sacrifice, dimensions in which they're selling for something other than they want exactly. And that ought to be explored, documented. And by the way, I believe that begins with observation, thus my book on observation, because early on when we had this concept, we actually did some like focus groups with customers and interview them and explain the concept, tell a few anecdotes. And I'd say, well, where do you customize? And after doing this two or three times and hearing the same standard answer from everybody, I don't know. Right. They're so not used to being asked what you want exactly. They can't even think about it. So you have to observe customers and know their behavior and their wants well enough that you could actually think about this on their behalf. Oh, that sounds like good management to me. That sounds like the foundation of good design to me. And so often, you know, we rely upon assumptions, past practices, and again, as opposed to watching people actually spend time experiencing your economic offerings. And again, the design community is increasingly understanding this.
Yes, and customer sacrifice is just solid gold advice because it forces you, or it forces a company, it seems, to observe in an almost ethnographic way, well, where are they sacrificing? There are lots of sacrifices. Put it another way, from some other books that have been on the show, they talk about find the friction in your customer's life. It's there.
Sure. But see, even with ethnography, that was the first group I spoke to when my lookbook came out. Even there, they're often looking for a lot of people wanting something, right? Why? Because they want to calculate an average. It's a new better average, you know, some new friction they discovered. But sometimes even a comment from a single customer, it may not be the particular way they articulate that, but they identify a dimension of which they can't have to look at the dimensions of which people vary. But for example, before you know, automated check at the airline, I go to the front counter. They'd say window or aisle. I go non-bulkhead. You know, they're concerned about that because nobody, they haven't even thought about the dimension. And oh, by the way, why do I want bulkhead? Because I want a place to store my briefcase and my laptop under my seat instead of overhead. Right? Oh, well, maybe I actually would like both. I'd actually like bulkhead for the lead room, but also be able to have easy access to my computer. Well, that identifies a new, you know, granted, sort of maybe, you know, tactical service that could be in bulkhead and basically gets a different kind of storage configuration that could be either designed for. Like, how about in the floor? I've often thought, like, why do we not have, like, pull up the floor and have a thing on? It's looking for dimensions that people would vary in it. And sometimes they're not even aware of it. They've been so conditioned.
Yes. Speaking of airlines.
Right. There are business books that actually advocate train your customer to accept something other than one exactly.
Right.
Why? So you can lower your costs and mass produce and do it one standard way. But every customer is unique. Even if they're not self-aware, they've been so beat down, like you said, like many airline passengers have been. I hope coming out of this, the airline industry, they rethink things like middle rows.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, middle seats, excuse me.
Yeah, well, I, of course, I do miss being frisked. That's really
yes,
why
of course,
I like to fly.
Of course.
But,
of course.
Well, let's so customer sacrifice, there's a lot of it out there. Tap into that. Very helpful. Let's go on to just a couple other things that just were so powerful for me. And again, this is one of the things in your book. You spend a lot of time on it. And it helped rewire my understanding of customer experience. And that is, work is theater. Hmm. And that's the title of chapter 6. And it's such a great paradigm. And you know, and having been a college actor, as I was, explain what you mean when you talk about work is theater, and also why you avoid saying work as theater.
Right. Well, work as theater is a metaphor. It's a model. Irving Goffman was the first, in sociology, was the first person to use theater as a model for human behavior in his book, The Presentation of Everyday Self. So we've taken and applied it to business. It's not a metaphor. It's a model. You can actually use the frameworks, the thinking, the constructs of good theater, of good drama, and apply them to how you design, how people spend time. And there's actually three chapters in the book
on
that subject.
Yeah, there's quite a bit. My sense is that there was more about that than other parts of the book.
Customization is right in there. It's so important. I think the environment design – has made great progress and will continue. It's the human element that is where the challenges will be. And of course, many service companies just want to get people out of the equation. That's their remedy. Just don't even have it.
Stupid people.
Right, exactly. So in fact, it will take less people to deliver services. That is going to be even accelerated in because of the corona crisis.
Yes.
It always takes less people to make goods. The people who are making goods, they are making robots so that other industries can have less people making goods.
Right.
So the human element, and it stems from you make a good, you deliver a service, but you stage an experience. Right. So work is theater. By the way, strategy is drama. Right? What story do you want to have unfold in the marketplace?
Yes, yes. Right?
I teach my undergraduate management that strategy is playful. Because it's about theater's about decision making, whether it's actors with their intention. It's all about decision making at every level. Well, that's business. That's management.
Right, right down to the button on the actors.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Which not a uniform, it's the principles of costuming, which by the way takes you to the principles of mask work. Right. And so I think that might be the most enduring part of our book that might be studied over time, and hopefully some progress will be made. And then we hold up the Geek Squad as our example, the brilliance of Robert Stevens, and people looking at the Geek Squad say, oh, that's a gimmick. No way. You told Robert Stevens that anything he does, the Geek Squad was a gimmick. He'd freak out. He had a reason for all of his choices. Right. Yeah. So whether it's the Geekmobile versus a minivan, so it's a driving demand creation vehicle to the costume. He doesn't force a uniform on employees like geeks like, give me the standard thing to wear. That's great. You know, even flashing of a Geek Squad badge was a hiring criteria. He didn't want people who are tech savvy who thought, oh, that's stupid. No, he wanted somebody who could be personally engaging, who thought, oh, cool, I'd love to show that badge. It made the hiring process so much more efficient based on that. Again, so thinking about theater, set design, don't interview, audition.
I love that section on HR. HR should be your casting department.
Right, exactly. Well, we have to thank our editor, Kirsten Sandberg, because the book was originally a 9-chapter book, and she said, something's missing. We're like, oh, after 2 rewrites, what now? Chapter 8 is the what chapter only written once, then revised for the updated edition. But so it needs an HR chapter. You got to apply all this theater model to like the different roles. So we actually borrow from the work of Schechner out of NYU, which is actually performance theory, which is even a level above theater. We draw a lot from his work about understanding certain mental constructs that can help you more richly understand why people value different dimensions of humor. And I think human interaction. And by the way, I think it's just like if you were an actor, it's self-actualizing. I think the theater is the model for having people enjoy their jobs better. Not by being theatrical, right? But recognize that it is theater. Not by being dramatic, but understanding that it is drama. And those chapters are just rich with frameworks to challenge people to think about how work is performed.
Very much so. And it made for a slower read for all the right reasons. I didn't want to skip through it. And there was even one part that resonated with me, maybe unlike any other reader, where you talk about, I think there was a doctoral dissertation that was being done by another person at NYU about street performers.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea of the street performer, and I've seen street performers, and it's really so impressive. And the reason it came to me is that I, over the years, a lot of businesses and clients are self-oriented, and they'll say, well, we want to talk about ourselves and our products and our all these mm-hmm. things. And it's almost like I want to steal that and say, well, let me ask you something. Have you ever seen a street performer? And they'll say yes. And they'll say, what got you to pay attention to him? Because you could have kept walking. It's the same sort of thing in this attention economy. Yeah. As a street performer. In other words, just like that quote I read earlier, you can't really interrupt your way into the attention. You have to be more like a street performer to deliver value from the very beginning. And then it even has the part in there about how they ask for the money at the end. It was brilliant. I'm stealing it, Mr. Gilmore.
Yeah, well, good. Well, you mentioned that to me earlier that many of your listeners are in sales, but most good salespeople are street performers. Right.
Yes.
We talk about four types of theater. I'll talk about how we came up with this early, but platform theater is like, say your lines. Here's the 17 things why reason you ought to buy our widget. And you rattle them off, whether they're all applicable or not. But a street performer senses and responds.
Yes.
Right. Has 17 things in their you know, toolkit, but takes them off the shelf. By the way, only exactly what they have to say to make the sell. And then they shut up.
Yes.
Right. They were sold and you had to go mention that too. Like, so this came because I've had a long time love for street theater. I was on a temporary assignment in my early days of Procter & Gamble in San Francisco. And every day I would zigzag through Chinatown and actually follow an entire New York Giants baseball game by all the shops that would have the game on either by radio or TV. And I'd make my way to Pier 39, where every day for like 3 months, I went to see Butterfly Man. You know, he was like Gallagher looking with long hair on the side. He actually had a butterfly tattoo on the top of his head. One of the best jugglers I've ever seen, and clearly one of the most polished street performers. And by going every day, I saw the structure that if you just were there, a tourist there for one day, you would not see. And that was, he had this portfolio of different combinations and different bits that he would put together in different combinations depending on how the audience responded. You know, the guy walking across the back ignored me. He had a thing to, heckle out to him. If he's juggling knives, depending on how the person behaves below him, he'll behave differently. And once we said work is theater, once we said you stage experience, you know, I just was ravenous with theater books. And from Stanislavski down to, you know, books about auditioning. And when I was reading Sally Harrison Pepper's book, Drawing a Circle in the Square, it dawned on me that street theater is that mass customization is street theater, right? And then we have a model of four different. The model that actually caused me to write Joe Pine, my now co-author and business partner, is he had a model about invention, mass production, continuous improvement, and mass customization. It was a framework that went. I was using the term mass customization, but this framework defined it. So with these four different paradigms of work, I go, well, you know, mass customization is street theater, portfolio of bits you take off the shelf in different combinations and sequences. Then I thought, well, you know, invention is improv. No two performances alike, right? Yes. And I went, well, mass production, that's say your lines. That's platform theater. Like, and then the icing on the cake was reading a book called From Stage to Screen. Babbage, I think, was the whole book was about an actor whose career is on the stage, you know, live theater, and has to migrate to film, and how very different that is, because in film is editing, and a good actor in film has to recognize you're shooting a scene today, and shooting a scene 3 weeks from today, and those two scenes need to match. If you don't, it's a jump cut, it's mismatched. Mm-hmm. So we coined matching theater. Right, which somebody needs to orchestrate all the episodes that your customers encounter with you, because they see it episodically. They don't see your daily operations. Right, is the email that goes out and your sales call and your letter are they harmonized to be in a certain? Again, that's script writing. Right, so again, all the principles of writing a good script. So those four types of theater. There are times when you want to say your lines, like an investor relations meeting for Wall Street. Like, don't deviate. Now's not the time to improv. You know, there's time good salespeople tend to do street theater, which, by the way, and if they're outside sales, they're going to people's offices where they don't command the stage. They have to appropriate everything in their room as a prop. But they'll jump over to improv whenever they encounter something they've never had to deal with before. And if it works, they'll then put it in their portfolio of routines. In fact, the passage that hit me in Sally Harrison's book, she interviewed this gentleman by the name of Tony Vera, who was called the King of Washington Square. She spent 3 summers studying the street performers in Washington Square in New York, which, of course, is right by NYU's campus. And when any Tony Vera would come out with his act, all the other acts would recede into the background. He'd draw a circle in the square with a piece of chalk, mm-hmm. just the title of the name. And she had the diagram of, based on interviewing him, of all the way he put sequences together. And she asked him, at one point, she shares this in the book. She says, and this is another piece of brilliant business wisdom. She asked him, well, Tony, like, what bits do you decide to like keep in and which ones you decide to take out? And he says, well, I try something, and if it works, I keep it in, and if it doesn't work, I take it out.
Sounds like brilliant. Iteration.
It's just brilliant. Exactly. It's just brilliant. And so I think good salespeople and even good marketing people, you know, you have this portfolio of things you rely upon in different situations. You're keen. Boy, your observers, your listeners – You know, you can see tells like a good poker player. But every once in a while, you'll have to like, boy, I've never heard that objection before. By the way, objections are always opportunities, right? Because if you can find out why they're objecting, you find out about a new need, a new reason to address, right? They're all objections are not obstacles. They're gold.
Yes, and even write like a marketing person, they want to prepare content, let's say, for the sales team. Yeah. One of the most valuable things you can get the conversation going with, so what are the objections that you get in the process of a sales, Boom. That's gold. Yeah.
Even the marketing department does their job and actually has richly identified all the reasons to buy and they equip the sales force. By the way, if the marketers are really doing their job, we'll quote Peter Drucker here, the purpose of marketing is to make selling superfluous. Right. If you create a willing customer, you don't have to sell them. But let's say, you know, there's oftentimes
it's a worthy goal.
Right. It's a goal. And oftentimes you still need that salesperson to completely understand.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought.
About content?
Oh yeah. So even something as simple, so let's say they do their job. Thank you. They really have understand all the things you could possibly say. And they put in a PowerPoint presentation. You don't do that sequentially like platform theater. You go through the 27 slides. If you got 27 reasons, you know, this is very fundamental. I teach my students this. You know, in PowerPoint, if you enter 12, 1-2 enter, you go to slide 12, and 1-7 enter, you go to 17. You don't have to go through PowerPoint in a linear fashion like it's platform theater. You can bounce around. And if you know what's on what slide, oh, by the way, every actor has to memorize their lines.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Or their bits. But street theater, they understand what they're going to say on each slide. They're going to understand. If this comes up, I say this. If this comes up, I say this. Again, something as elemental as that, right? And by the way, then can we have a copy of your slides? Well, yeah, if you remember what they picked and you're able to only send them those slides, you're not showing them the extraneous things that's wasting their time to read through.
Exactly. Again,
our book has the models and the frameworks, and some of them are, you know, are conceptual, but, you know, you got to think conceptually to understand what it is you want to then take down and make reality every day.
Yeah, I loved it. And it's your book even got a conversation going with my content director, and he's a very interesting guy. And one thing that drives him nuts in movies is continuity errors.
Oh, like it's called jump cut.
Yeah, so that's how it came up in your book. It's like, so then of course I went down this rabbit hole of continuity errors, and like in The Wizard of Oz.
Classic.
In the same song, her hair is long and then it's short.
Exactly. I used to love Melrose Place because I actually think they did it on purpose. But Heather Locklear was famous, like every single scene, her hair's behind her ear, that's over her ear. And it was like notorious for like, I think they did it intentionally as like a hearkening back to camp from the 60s.
So with these experiences, I mean, like even myself dealing with folks that have been, you know, repairing my home and replacing my water heater, all this sort of thing, there are so many continuity errors. And it'll just introducing the idea of minimizing
matching theater.
Matching, yes, exactly. Theater. That's what the matching theater. The whole part of your book. So I just
anytime you have to repeat something to some customer, I told you this already. That can happen on a single phone call where you have to, you know, give your thing 12, or especially they make you enter it in.
Yes. Right? And then, oh, I mean, just, my goodness.
Goodness gracious.
I had my my bike repaired recently, and I went for the first time to a bike shop, and it was a nightmare. And I got so infuriated that I left a review, because even their response to the review tells you that they just didn't get it. But I had to explain the same thing about four different times over a couple of days. And I mean, it's not like they have that many employees. And so it was driving me nuts. It was like one continuity error after another.
Not to roll even more content out. I mean, we have someone once called us Frameworks RS. We have so much. I mean, we call that learning relationships. Every time you interact with a customer, the purpose is not just to fulfill the immediate need or task. It's to simultaneously learn about the uniqueness of that customer that maybe not in the very next interaction, but someday and soon, and for the rest of your lives with the customer, to wink at Casablanca, you'll change something down the road. Right. You know, many organizations, the problem is whether I interact with you, the customer interacts with them 5 times, 15 times, or 50 times, the behavior nature never changed. Whenever you interact with a customer, buyer and seller, both parties learn about the uniqueness of the other customer. And eventually, somebody changes their behavior. Sadly, that's too often the customer.
Right.
Right? Because they sense and respond to what you're capable of and adjust accordingly, as opposed to the customer saying, oh, I see, it's not exactly what you need. We might not be able to solve that right away, but we're going to go work on that. Right.
Yes.
In fact, maybe we'll even involve you in that. I won't tell the company, but I will say, early when the book came out, I loved when I went back to Procter & Gamble, my old employer. I was a logistician. I was supply chain. My first job was railroad tank cars. And they had me like spend days in 1 hour sessions with like every brand in the soap department. I just loved doing this. And one of the things that came up, and I still think it's a good idea for them or for many others, Procter & Gamble spends so much money on advanced research, right? Coming up with new chemistry, and very little of it actually makes it to the marketplace. And they might sell off some chemical technology. Is that why don't they sell subscriptions to the research, right? To participate. By the way, the research will be better through your active participation. So again, that's the idea of rigorously asking ourselves what opportunities do we have where time with us would be valued. Instead, we wait for the output to come out at the end, right? As opposed to charging for the journey or the time you spend. Doing the research, not the output from the research in that particular example.
Yes, and there was and we don't have time to go into it, but there was a concept in the book about how learning from your customers is such a competitive advantage.
Oh.
And it's waste. So many companies waste it. There's so much to learn from your customers, and they're happy to share it with you.
To briefly loop back, I talked about customer satisfaction and customer sacrifice. It's part of our 3S model, which we call customer surprise, right? Which you don't usually, that's a bad word, like don't surprise customers. But you basically, the definition here is it's the gap between what people expect and what they get to perceive.
Yes.
In other words, don't set expectations, right? Here's what I'm going to do for you. All you can do is be satisfaction. But by our 3S model, jokingly, has a 4S, which is suspense. Ooh, what will they do next time? Because
right.
They've learned enough about me that I'm looking forward to the next sales call, next thing, because like, wow. And then finally, we cap it all off. And I think this is unspoken in the book. I don't think we do. But customer secret, which is your point. Do customers confide in you? Do you know things about them uniquely? This is why that relationship cannot be replicated by competition. The
yes.
unique relationship you have with every single customer is the one and probably only thing, other than things protected by copyright and so forth. That is uniquely yours with a customer, right? And
yes.
if you learn enough about their uniqueness and respond to it, not everything, right? But those dimensions that you choose to take your current capabilities or develop capabilities to respond to, that's a way of increasing switching costs.
Yes, yes, that was great. You mentioned to truly differentiate themselves, businesses must focus on increasing customer satisfaction, which you mentioned, then on eliminating customer sacrifice, which you have to know what it is first, and then you write, and finally, on creating customer surprise. Jim, just one last question about
sure.
this. You take us through commodities to goods to services to experiences, and then you say, you know, just when we're up to speed on experiences, you explain that it's actually going beyond
right.
that to transformations.
Yeah.
Can you touch on that?
Sure. Well, using the same heuristic, if you customize experience, you automatically turn into a transformation. That is, we are all changed by the goods we use and the services we buy and where we spend time. So with the same notion, not just transformational experiences, but rather charging explicitly for the change, charging explicitly for the demonstrated outcome. And the most immediate applications, I would say, because I went to the University of Pennsylvania, you know, Ben Franklin School,
right.
is early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. If we take the sectors of healthcare, wealth management, and education, those are three primary opportunities that, in fact, what people most seek are transformations, right?
Yes.
They're sick, they want to be healthy, right? They want their assets to grow, to become larger, and they want to learn. Let's just start with education, though. In the United States, only about 53% of students that matriculate in college and universities graduate within 6 years. It's a huge failure rate,
mm-hmm.
right? What if you only paid all or part of tuition upon graduation, in order for the demonstrated outcome, not just the tuition for the time you spend semester to semester? It would force the university to behave differently. Oh, by the way, if you do get your degree, this is Obama Administration Education Department, only 44% of college graduates are in a job that requires a college education. And then I read in the Wall Street Journal this week
that because of Corona crisis, there's been a 45% decrease in offers to college graduates. if we had those percentages on planes and with bridges, I mean, so a part of it, if you have to behave differently, if you charge for demonstrated outcomes, right, when you graduate or when you get job placement, it will move much more to what they talk about long-term learning. You have to do much more coaching longer term. You know, take wealth management. That is definitely being challenged by all the fees that are being extracted, right? It's being commoditized. I like the term wealth care. Right.
Yes.
How does your wealth behave? Not just how does it grow, but if it grows, what are you going to do with it? Much more of a broader, you know, we do have, you know, the life coaching stuff that's emerging. But
you also have to deeply understand what people's goals and motivations
are. Sure. That they may not, how about this? Here's the ultimate goal. When I interact with you, I discover things about myself I did not know.
Yes.
That's the relationship you really, now that you put it that way, use your wisdom, not just your knowledge, to guide and take health care. At least in the United States, it's been a conversation about health insurance services. I don't pay my plumber if he doesn't fix the drain. Why is somebody paying for chemo if they don't get well? My dad in his later years, he had a pacemaker put in. It extended his life by 6 months. Huge amount of money to the medical device company. Huge amount of money to the surgeon. Why am I just paying for the time it extended his life? And by the way, I never forget the session when came out of surgery and we get the device to monitor things at home and, you know, walk through a little canned presentation about what to do. And, you know, and it's got, you know, telemetry, you can, you know, hook it up, you know, internet. Then I go, my dad doesn't even have internet in his house. He's 80 years old. Mm-hmm. There's no like extending, we have the capability to come in and setting that up for you. And so, well, you can also hook it up to the phone. I'm like, the phone's in the kitchen. He's sleeping in the bedroom. It's just healthcare. And I think it's largely in America because there's not enough competition, right? There's not enough innovation that if you charge for demonstrated outcomes, right, and let the market work to let there be competition to, and I think it's by disease state. If there was a diabetes club, right, the cost of manufacturing of insulin is like next to nothing per ounce, right? Yet the price, everybody's talking about the price point of it. Well, the basic issue with diabetes, by the way, is compliance.
Hmm.
You know, it's monitoring. And we have all these devices to monitor, right? But what if you just paid an annual fee or a membership for the necessary coaching equipment? The equipment was subsumed inside of it. You participated in research. I have a good friend, Bob Gio, with his company, Diasome, paradigm breaking, focusing on the liver, not the pancreas. I mean, to much more participatory into new kinds of solutions to age old diseases. But instead, we're having arguments over health insurance, and it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's a wicked problem, as my colleague Dick Buchanan at Weatherhead would say. I recognize the complexity of that particular endeavor. Right.
Well, Jim, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Well, let's maybe mention something we haven't touched on, which is we talked about the foundational model being the progression of economic value, but the first principle of experience thinking is based on a little cute thing, you know, cute. Some might think a cutesy, but we talk about ing the thing.
Oh, yes. Right.
That in English, the words we use for experiences end in ing, skiing, hiking, camping. So thinking in terms of ing words in English. I'm always fascinated. Our book's in like 18 languages. So I'm always fascinated with how other languages deal with this ing the thing, gerunds in English. But I'd be like looking for ing, like, you know, binge watching on television. Okay, Wall Street Journal this week, the Human Interest article is all about pandemic decluttering. Okay, and what are the new activities are always emerging, and they tend to be ing words, right? Mm-hmm. Planking, whatever. So think in terms of ing words, right? Design the ing, not the noun. That would be probably the one thing we haven't touched upon, which I think would be a nice little mental model for people.
Yeah. Well, what books have most inspired your working career?
Oh, working career.
And career, yeah.
There you go. With work.
Or your life, yeah.
That's interesting. With work, what do I tend to, when it comes to experiences, I would tend
like a
to,
seminal book that maybe you discovered after you got out of pen or something like that.
Yeah, maybe I'll do a quick
Well, right out of Penn, George and Gilder's Wealth and Poverty was the first book I read about how capitalism can be altruistic with the principle of potlatching that I referred to earlier. So that was
interesting.
Absolutely key. I love Gilder's work on the whole. With experience economy, the books I tend to point people to, besides Sally Harrison Pepper's Drawing a Circle in the Square on Street Theater, definitely Michael Benedict, who teaches architecture at the University of Texas at Austin, wrote this essay book called For an Architecture of Reality, where he talks about the direct aesthetic experience of the real, aesthetic with an E, which is where I picked up on that. He talks about why is it that people enter some space and almost immediately they want to leave versus other spaces you enter like, I like it here. I like to spend time here. Mm. It's the hangout value that we borrow from 40s. And when it comes to work as theater, I might say almost anything by David Mamet, but particularly his book, Three Uses of a Knife. Very simple, tight read. He's a brilliant script writer. And so that book talks about the idea of montage and sort of a play in three acts and is a good introduction, I think, to theater, to those who are not students like yourself. And then lately, frankly, I've been reading a lot of technology, quite frankly, even anti-technology or anti-big data, just because I do think there's increasingly people are spending time with the screen and with companies. We know who they are that are basically, basically intentionally making things more addictive, which is spending time in some ways against your will. Mm-hmm. So, whether it's like World Without Mind, I love that math destruction or two of my sort of favorite. Now, I don't agree with everything in the book, but they're nice provocations. Jason Lanier's You Are Not a Gadget, that type of thing.
Interesting.
And actually reaching back, I've been rereading, I'll get real highbrow with you. I've been rereading Jacques Ellul, which I read in my 20s, a French Christian anarchist, actually. It's a weird description, but he actually, a quote that I plucked from one of his book, I think The Technological Society, he said back in the 70s, he said the technological system has replaced the capitalist system. And that, I've been rereading him, I've been rereading Marshall McLuhan. But to me, the criticism of capitalism that we have today is really somewhat misguided because the wealth of Silicon Valley has not been generated by profits. The Milton Friedman, the social responsibility of businesses make a profit. Oh, right. My, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. They make it through market capitalization. The founder of Uber, they've never made a profit, yet he's a billionaire. A sexual scandal. So to me, technology is the dominant force in society. And again, we have a lot of technology that are coming out of non-capitalistic countries. Hello, China. So I think this, how much of our experiences in our time is going to be digitally enabled versus that, which is not just a hybrid, which my co-author Joe Pine is really fascinated with, is sort of the fusing of the two. But I am increasingly having heart for getting people to spend more time away from the screen, more time away from the phone. And I'm hoping even all of the Zoom time or other platforms we're spending might whet people's appetite to actually unplug a little bit.
Oh, you're talking to the person that's experiencing that. I can't stand
it. I own no smartphone. I own no mobile phone. It's perfectly capable. By the way, when everybody else has one, you don't need one. Right. You can bum it like a cigarette. And I have.
Yes, yes.
So again, I'm not a Luddite, but I really think my book on observation is saying, how do you really want to spend your time with your eyes? And I yes. tell my students, the smartphone can access wonderful things, amazing things. It's totally impressive. But recognize everything you see from that is derivative, right? Pay more attention to the immediate environments in which you're situated. Mm. Right, and that's where my heart, and that might point to some of my non-business readings. If I would say like one of my favorite all-time books, it would, if I can get non-business on you.
Oh yes,
Robert Farrar Capon books on Jesus's parables. That's an escape for everyday life. Wow. I don't care what your religious convictions are, but you read this thing. This guy was an Episcopal priest, but also a food critic for the New York Times. It's just a fascinating guy.
Interesting.
It's the book I probably reread. I probably have seven different highlighter colors in the thing. So that's the parable. His book on the parables.
Oh, interesting. So. There's actually an author who's been on this podcast a couple times over the years named Nir Eyal, whose work you might like. He wrote the book Hooked about how companies create addictive products.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar.
He has another one, and your students may like this too, called Indistractable. And he explores the nature of what is it that is distracting us. And it doesn't mean necessarily getting rid of a phone or whatever, but it was both of them are done they're almost a companion. I think you might really like the book Indistractable.
Talk about another influence, last story on books. The only research paper I wrote in high school was 12th grade math class, Mr. Hahn. Math class. We had to pick a mathematician at random off a sheet he passed around the room. I got Blaise Pascal.
Oh.
And his book, Poncés, Fragments of Thoughts, they're like tweets, right? I'm talking about distraction, right? I mean, man is most miserable when he's in a room alone, right? You know, I need something to do.
That's why the phone works so well.
Right, exactly. And that's why mindfulness is sort of like, to be Hegeling a bit, is like the notion of that thing is fascinating to me, is what do people really want versus how are their, and I'm not John Kenneth Galbraith in terms of, you know, taste formation, but the technologies are not neutral. That's why I'm reading McLuhan. I mean, they're not neutral. You have to, Jocko Lull had 76 questions to ask of any technology. Go Google that. The irony.
Oh my goodness.
Go Google. It's like, I like to tell people Google Nick Carrs is Google making us stupid just for the irony.
Mm. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable. And this is going to be probably one of the longest.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, it's going to be one of the longest series of links because you've mentioned so many things and links to all the books you've mentioned in the articles and your site and your LinkedIn profile. So listeners connect with you and thank you for joining us on the show. And for you, dear listener, if you've enjoyed this interview and you found it helpful, please reach out to Jim and thank him for being a guest. It will really make his day. Past guests on the Marketing Book Podcast have told me they just love hearing from the listeners. So also, if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to this Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Experience Economy, Competing for Customer Time, Attention, and Money. The authors are Joseph Pine and James Gilmore. Governor, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for the time.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.